Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I am Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. And I am happy to be joined today again by my chum and colleague, Josh Blank, who is research director of the Texas Politics Project here at the very same institution. How are we doing in the midst of poll rollout, Josh?
Doing pretty well. I'm glad to be back on the podcast. It's been a minute.
It's been a minute.
I feel like. Yeah, maybe I did last week and not the week before. It just shows where we are right now, 3 weeks after the election. I don't know what happened last week. I don't know what's happening next week. I just floating along, I guess.
Yeah, it's between the election, the poll rollout, being generally busy, and the pandemic, who knows where we are at any given time.
Yeah.
So, as I mentioned, we are in the midst of rolling out the October version of the University of Texas Texas Tribune poll, and we thought we'd start talking today about some of those results. It will probably occupy us for a couple of weeks. Last Friday, we released the trial ballots for our statewide Texas poll, which mainly focused on the presidential and the Senate race, and then yesterday, which would have been Monday as we record this, we released a bunch of interesting items on Texans' views of the conduct of the election early voting starts today. And so the election is underway at long last to some degree. So we thought we'd talk about those early results and whatever else we wander into. I'd urge people to go to the Texas Tribune and see the continuing rollout. We have one more day. Tomorrow on Wednesday, we will release results that focus on race and policing and the general mood of the state. And there's some real interesting results in that. But for today, I think we'll recap and kind of dig down a little bit into what we got on the trial ballots and what Texans said about elections and the mood about elections out there. So what struck you about the trial ballots, Josh?
Well, I mean, I think, first, just to paint a broad picture, I would just say, overall among likely voters, and that's where we are now. We're at the point in the election when we can't just assume that, the attitudes of all registered voters are going to reflect the actual electorate on election day. So we want to really focus our insights here on those voters who seem most likely to participate. And overall, we found that in Texas at this point, we see Donald Trump leading Joe Biden by 5 points among likely voters 50 to 45. We see a slightly larger lead for Senator John Cornyn against his challenger, MJ Hager. I think is he at 50 to 42? Is that what it right?
Sort of 44. Oh, yeah, 42. That's right. Yeah, 50 to 42. That's right.
50 to 42, so an 8-point lead over MJ Hager. And, while I think just broadly contextually, you may look at this and think, oh, I thought, Democrats were going to be real competitive in Texas this year. And ultimately, this is a reflection of increased competitiveness, just to sort of begin with the first insight here, which is that, I would say, having done this now, and you and I have been working on this stuff for 10 years, we sort of assume previously that, you basically put any Republican up against any Democrat statewide in Texas, you kind of start with a 10-point lead for the Republican. And it's not really like that anymore, right?
Yeah, I mean, and even 10 points is a relatively recent development. I mean, I think we could,
right. Well, that's my floor.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and Republicans are not reaching that in polling this time. And I think, the historical perspective, of course, is that if you go back to 2012, which is relatively, a little ways ago, but no, not that long ago, Mitt Romney beat Barack Obama in Texas by 14 points. And then in 2014, Greg Abbott wins the governorship by 20 points over Wendy Davis, now back in the news. Mm-hmm. 2016, Donald Trump wins by 8.75 points. And then when we get to 2018, things get a little more complicated. On one hand, Greg Abbott wins re-election by 14 points, not quite the 20-point gap that he enjoyed in 2014. But Ted Cruz only wins by 2 3/4, and then you have the other statewide officials at various points in between that 2 3/4 and 8 3/4 point. So, or 14 points, I guess, that if we use Abbott as the high watermark for 2018. And so things are definitely changing. And, I think you're right. There's a certain amount of, I think there was a certain amount of snooze factor in some ways that some people implicitly expressed when they saw that we had a 5-point race. But that's, at the presidential level, but that's really something.
Yeah. And I think it's really something because I think, because if you're sitting here as someone who really does follow this stuff closely, like we do, and just imagine, the impact of the changes that you're talking about on the types of conversations we have with people where, if you were to go and talk to us 6 years ago and say, hey, what do you think this generic Republican, the top of the ticket, is going to beat this Democrat by, we would say, somewhere between 8 and 15 points. And now, based on what we've seen recently, in the last couple of election cycles, but also the polling, I think we're increasingly thinking, well, it's probably somewhere between Beto O'Rourke's 2.5-point loss to Cruz and Donald Trump's 9-point victory over Hillary Clinton. The Democrats are somewhere in that range of, they're within probably 2.5 to 9 points of the Republican candidate, sort of more as a starting point than necessarily as an ending point. And I think, that in and of itself is making, these races more interesting and more competitive and shows sort of a difference in the state. In particular, I like the way you set that up, actually. Sort of there's something about being a pollster. You produce some results, and then inevitably, no matter what the results are, someone says, well, yeah, that's obvious. yeah, of course. Good for you.
Well, and at some level, what I think people miss in that is, in a certain way, my reaction to that is, well, good.
Right. Absolutely. I don't mind that either. But, but I think that's why, there's some value in the time series that we have, because, as someone, again, if you're anyone who's interested in looking at data, one of the first questions you have to ask yourself, once you have some good data is, well, compared to what? Right. You get some information. It tells you, and you say, well, what is this? Right. And that's kind of what we're trying to do here. Just talking about it first, we just say, let's set expectations properly. But also one of the nice things about the time series is we can go and make these comparisons. So, we do a trial ballot every election around October. So ultimately we can go back and make comparison points. And I think the thing that's sort of most notable, and, I don't know if it's durable. I mean, that's sort of a question for another podcast, but I think the most sort of durable seeming change for this election is the shift in attitudes among independent voters towards the Republican Party. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, before we move on to that, just if you look at this trend data, the trend data among Republican identifiers in things like Donald Trump's job approval, various aspects of how we sort of gauge where partisans are,
right,
they're largely unchanged over the length and breadth of the Trump presidency. But independents, as it turns out, are not looking like that, right?
Well, no, and thanks for bringing that up, because that's important. That's an important point, because it would be easy enough to sort of say, without, again, a deeper look at the data, well, surely some Republicans are walking away from Donald Trump. That seems to be kind of a popular, thought or talking point or assumption. And the truth is, there's really no evidence of that. And if anything, actually, Donald Trump looks stronger among Republicans right now than he did in 2016. In that election, one of the questions we asked on the October poll when Trump was running against Clinton was, for all the Trump supporters, we said, is your vote more of a vote for Trump or against Clinton? And then we asked all the Clinton voters, is your vote a vote for Clinton or against Trump? And back in 2016, only 40% of Trump voters said their vote was for Trump. 53% said it was against Clinton. Jump ahead to 2019, and it's 81% say for Trump, 19% say against Biden. And again, take that along with job approval numbers, favorability numbers, just any sort of item in the poll. And there's really no indication that Trump is suffering among Republicans. Actually, if anything, that's really, he's relying on Republicans to be where he is. But historically, I think what's produced, slightly larger margins, especially for Republicans, is that, we've had independent voters in Texas. These are voters who don't identify with either the Democratic or Republican Party, even when pushed to sort of say, you know, do you lean towards one of the parties? And they just say no. And this makes up about 10% of the electorate. And generally, you know, if the margins are Republicans winning by at least 10, 15, 20 points, well, then it doesn't necessarily matter what independents think. But historically, they've leaned conservative. They tended to favor the Republican candidates in most elections. What was interesting was when we polled in 2018, Beto O'Rourke was polling better than Ted Cruz among independents. And I think that was a large part of Beto's smaller margin relative to, or tighter margin with Cruz relative to the other Democrats running statewide. But he was the only one, because independents, again, if you looked at the governor's trial ballot, if you looked at who they said they were voting for in the congressional race, the Democratic or Republican candidate, those independents were still polling for the Republican candidate. What's interesting about this poll and this cycle is that Republicans on every race we polled, so for president, for Senate, for congressional trial ballot, and for Texas House, are expressing a preference for the Democratic candidate. And I'm pretty sure, you know, that this is, you know, like most things about this election cycle related to Donald Trump, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at Trump's approval ratings over, you know, the last year, there's been a pretty clear trend. Independents have moved around as they're wont to do. And I'm going to want to say a couple things. I think we should say a couple things just about independents per se before we get out of this topic. But, you know, Donald Trump has been underwater. That is, his job approval numbers, his negative job approval or his disapproval have been higher than his approval numbers for the last year. And they widened out to their widest, to the widest gap in this October poll that we just released, so that 53% disapproved of the job Trump is doing as president, only 31% approved. And critically, 15% didn't have an opinion. Now, that's characteristic of independents. You know, on average, looking at these job approval numbers, independents tend to be, you know, twice as likely to not have a view of the president as partisans. And, you know, that's definitional to independents. But it's definitely has something to do with Trump. I agree with that. I mean, if you look at that job approval number, and interestingly, if you look at the favorability ratings among independents toward Joe Biden, it's not as if independents woke up one day and they're on fire for Joe Biden. Right. His favorability ratings among independents are not great. I mean, he's at, you know, 38% favorable and 46% unfavorable, which is not setting the world on fire when you just ask independents in isolation about whether they have a favorable or unfavorable view of Joe Biden. But their unfavorable views, you know, of Donald Trump are much higher. And if you look at the presidential trial ballot, independents were 37 Trump Pence, 45 Biden Harris, about 11% sprinkled along the third party candidates, and 7% saying that they wanted someone else. So, you know, Biden is enjoying an 8%, you know, advantage over Trump on the trial ballot. And, you know, that 45% is, you know, 10 or so, or, you know, 8 or so points higher than Biden's favorability rating. So, you know, there's some support for Biden out there among independents, but it's not a groundswell of, you know, parades for Joe Biden among independents.
Right. But it does represent a massive change. I mean, just you mentioned that number, you know, among independents, Biden was leading Trump 45 to 37. And in our October 2016 poll, Donald Trump was leading Hillary Clinton among independents 47% to 19.
That's a let me ask you something that people have, a reporter asked me, actually it was Mark Baraback who was on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, as he's working on a big Texas story, I think. And
I like to imagine that Californians are as interested in Texas as Texans seem to be in California.
Yeah, it's an interesting question.
Anyway, another day. But the
question I would have that Mark asked, and you know, and I'm still kind of mulling it. How do you parse out the embrace of Trump with, you know, how much of that was just, you know, negative affect towards Hillary Clinton, which is one of the big, you know, you talked about the you know, the, you know, borderline meme of Republicans abandoning Trump in Texas, for which there's no evidence. There's a little more evidence for the fact that Hillary Clinton's negatives were high, But I'm wondering how you sort that out. I mean, there's not a very good empirical answer to that, I don't think. But
well, I mean, actually, it's funny. You know, I was thinking something kind of parallel to that as you were talking. I mean, one, I think first and foremost, after the 2016 election, it was hard not to come away with sort of the duh realization that, you know, Hillary Clinton is an individual politician, is a force unto herself, you know, in American politics, both positive and negative. And I think, you know, the context of that election in particular, you know, after two terms of a Democratic president and the idea of someone in Hillary Clinton running for president for whom, you know, a large share of, you know, people, Republicans especially, but also independents and even, you know, some Democrats held a negative view over based on, you know, again, her many, many years in public office, amongst other considerations about how they feel about her, just to be fair. You know, I think that it was pretty easy to say, hey, let's just take a chance on this guy is kind of, you know, would be sort of my impression of it at that point in time. You know, and that's not really where we are now. I think independents are probably more open to the change argument. You know, ultimately they're independents for a reason. If they really liked everything that, you know, the Democrats were doing in office, you know, maybe they'd be Democrats and vice versa. And so I think that's, you know, I think that's a part of it for sure. Okay. I mean, Hillary Clinton made a big, big impact, but ultimately, you know, the other side of this is I say this again, the context matters so much, right? Again, two Democratic terms in office and then Hillary Clinton coming in, you know, what I say to reporters often is, you know, set Donald Trump aside for a second, as hard as that is, and ask yourself, you know, what party would expect to win the presidential election and expect to have a good year in their congressional elections if, you know, they're overseeing a failed response to a pandemic, you know, an economy that, you know, is in the tank to some extent, and, you know, a crisis, a self-made crisis every week. I mean, ultimately, if you're a partisan, you can overlook this or you can justify it or you can filter that information, you know, in either direction. As an independent, you know, you're just kind of sitting there saying, boy, this isn't really great. And so ultimately, whether you like Joe Biden or not, he may just look like a better alternative, which is ultimately, I think, part of what the Biden campaign is predicated on.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's this whole inherently there's always a part of an incumbent president running for his or her second term that is always going to be the referendum piece. And I think given the conditions you described, the Biden campaign wants this to be entirely a referendum, you know, to the extent possible. You know, I want to kind of tease out one of the things that you got at there. And that is, you know, as we look at a Texas that is getting more competitive, and we look not just at the presidential election and for that matter, to the Senate election, which we should get to before we get out, is, you know, the other thing we're looking at are this whole range of congressional and state representative seats that we've been talking about, which in a lot of ways is really not to downplay the presidential election, but at the level of what's going on in the state and in the state political class and the people that are here working on the ground in the state, you know, the competitive races in the state House of Representatives and in Congress are really ground zero for the election. There was campaign finance data at the state level released by the Ethics Commission last week showed a handful of races where the candidates together had spent more than $1 million on a house race, which is a lot of money for a state house race. And a whole, you know, another, you know, large bucket of races where you were getting spending in, you know, the $600,000-$800,000 range, which means that some of those races before this is over will also go into the $1 million club. As we look at those that, you know, the number of those races that were decided by 5 points or less, I think it was something like 14 races and in 2018 that are these races, you look at these congressional races where there's several of those races that are being funded to the tune of, you know, many millions of dollars by outside groups, and say, you know, a lot of this really hangs on independence or may well hang on independence, obviously, in addition to the campaigns mobilizing their partisans.
Yeah.
It's stunning to think about that. But the point being that we're hanging this on a very unpredictable and essentially flighty group. And by flighty, I'm not insulting anybody who is an independent. Right. But compared to partisans, they're much less predictable. They are less attentive. They are, as a rule, less interested and less knowledgeable about politics. And yet they are really in the catbird seat and are going to have a determinative role this time.
You know, it's funny, you know, the way you describe that, I would say it was almost negative.
But, well, but, you know.
But it's funny, I mean, but the whole arc of that is interesting, right? Because you're bringing up the, you know, again, these congressional races, these state house races, and you and I have been talking, you know, a lot, especially about the tone of the races in Central Texas in particular, because this is where we are and we see it more. And I mean, you know, with, you know, an interesting consequence of that, and we're, you know, talking about this before is, you know, I think, you know, the most memorable sort of Abbott ad from the last cycle for me, I think was, you know, one of these sort of, you know, fire and brimstone fear based sort of immigration appeals, right? And it sort of related a little bit to Law and Order, but that was the one that sort of stuck out to me. But it also is something that, you know, again, reflects public opinion within the Republican base, where the most important issue has been and continues to be immigration and border security. It's one of the few sort of issues that Republicans can kind of go to and know that it's going to unite, you know, their party. And what's interesting is, you know, you're not, at least in the broadcast space, you're not seeing those kinds of ads right now. You're not seeing ads that are sort of, you know, really geared towards the base, really, and even if anything, like the primary electorate base of either the Republican or the Democratic Party. You are seeing a lot more ads that are really about, I would just say, they're more genteel in tone, right? And it seemed to be targeted more towards these independent voters. Now, is that a good thing? I mean, I think generally, if we talk about more issues than the issues that, you know, animate a Republican or a Democratic primary, that's probably a good thing for everybody, even if it is, you know, based on a questionable set of voters.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something that's on one hand new to the recent history of Texas politics, and that, you know, we talk all the time, and it's oversimplified, but it's got the virtue of being reasonably accurate, that, you know, there's always kind of a mixture of persuasion and mobilization in these elections. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, given the fundamentals that we talked about a little bit ago in terms of the Republican advantages, we're talking mobilization elections where Republicans were trying to mobilize their base voters with the kind of appeals you're talking about. And you can, in a sense, narrow cast to those base voters. And there's always a little bit of feel good, you know, additions and positive ads, particularly Republican incumbents statewide, you know, in the period leading up to 2018, where you could take a lot of credit for the economy and the good times in Texas and take credit for
keeping
things seeming relatively stable. And if you were a Democrat, it was, you know, the constant refrain was, we've got to mobilize our base. We got to figure out how to appeal to Democrats and get all the non-voting Democrats out, and then we'll be competitive again. And that is all going on right now, but it's also going on, you know, with this other layer of newfound attention, a larger share of attention and resources going to what are being deemed, you know, what are always deemed, you know, persuadable voters, those that are not wedded to the Republican Party, but that can somehow be persuaded. And what persuades them are in some ways more conventional ads.
Yeah, I mean, more conventional issues. It is about the economy, right?
You know, I mean, things we've done, you know, I've done this for, you know,
right.
You know, for, you know, on an issue area, you know, with, I'm thinking about the Corning campaign, how, you know, I mean, there, you know, the most recent ad is an attack ad on Hagar that then, you know, moves into a contrast space by talking about, you know, some of the presumably agreeable things that Cornyn claims to have been involved in, you know, some healthcare measures, violence against women,
police reform, ideas. I mean,
right.
You know, but I mean, I think, you know, and again, I think the polling speaks directly to this, which is, you know, among likely voters in our Senate and presidential trial ballots, John Cornyn and Donald Trump are both at 50%. Which sounds, you know, pretty good. It's a good place to be. I'd like to be at 50% if I was MJ Hager or Joe Biden. Except that when you go into the internals of that and look at the partisan identification within the likely voters, 50% of the likely voters identified as Republicans. Now, not all Republicans are voting for Trump, and not all non-Republicans are voting against Trump and Cornyn. But ultimately, you know, neither candidate is outpolling their base, which I think is a problem, and which is why we're seeing, you know, again, I think, you know, ads and approaches that are sort of unusual for Texas Republicans, at least in the last, you know, 10 years.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, and I think another final piece of that is that 50% number is really telling, you know, the point about you know, them being right at the Republican share of the sample. You know, part of what's difficult is that, you know, we talked about a few minutes ago about the notion of this election being a referendum. You know, we asked people what was on their mind when they voted, and we gave them an open-ended question that we then kind of sorted into different categories, and nothing predominated in that issue battery, right? Mm-hmm. And it kind of underlines the fact that at the end of the day, this is an election that's being defined by Donald Trump, and that poses some dilemmas for Republicans.
Yeah, especially if you're one of these, you know, congressional or state house Republicans who has already, whose district was already competitive in the last cycle, because it usually is, you know, a large swath of, you know, sort of rural area that has then also, you know, sticks a toe into one of the major metros, but on its way out goes through these suburbs where ultimately, again, you know, Donald Trump is not doing as well as he was against Hillary Clinton. And really, you know, this is the sort of what they're fighting against.
You know, and those districts have changed.
Yeah, and those districts have changed, you know, over the 10 years, you know, in pretty dramatic ways.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there's kind of a subtle point there is that, you know, I mean, Donald Trump, you know, it's, you know, the Texas Republican Party is Trump country, as we mm-hmm. wrote earlier this week. You know, so if you're a candidate running against a Republican, what you're trying to do is shave off, you know, a pretty small, but not zero level, you know, group of Republican voters who have soured on Trump. And again, you know, Trump's numbers are still in the high 80s, early 90s among those voters. So there's not very many. But the back of the envelope math is if you can add a percent or two to your column mm-hmm. of those disaffected voters. And again, it's not a sign of widespread disaffection, but it's a piece of the solution. Mobilize as many Democratic voters as you possibly can, and then enjoy, you know, another advantage, you know, another 3 or 4% that comes in the total from this thin slice of independence or better. You know, that adds up to an ability to close a gap of 5 to 7 or 8 points.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And, you know, in that sense, then if you're a Republican and you're seeing that what's getting your opponent sort of over the line is defections, you know, even a few defections from Trump, and the fact that Trump is turning off. You know, a bigger share of independents than are normally turned off of Republicans in a general election. You know, you're going to be trying different things like, you know, peaceful images of you in a ballpark,
for example,
or, you know, being at a food bank, mm-hmm. or, you know, some other image that, you know, may be a little bit at odds with what the Republican brand has been for most of the last few cycles.
Yeah. And one other thing to say about this is just, you know, one of the other sort of thoughts out there is that maybe there'll be a lot of ticket splitting where, you know, maybe Joe Biden gets a vote, but John Cornyn gets a vote from that same voter, or that Republican voter again votes, you know, votes for Biden, but then votes Republican the rest of the ticket. And again, I mean, just to point out, like, look, that may end up being a very small share of the electorate. And when I say a very small share, we're talking about, you know, under 2%. Because ultimately, number one, the problem with that argument is it assumes that, you know, there are Republicans who have a problem with Donald Trump, and ultimately the polling doesn't really show a very large share or even significant share of Republicans with negative attitudes towards the president or who are concerned voting for somebody else. And then on top of that, you know, we can go and look through the data and say, are there a bunch of people who, you know, say they're voting for Trump, but, you know, or who say they're voting for Biden, but are then voting for Cornyn, and they're not. And same thing, we can look at the trial ballots and see that. Do we see, you know, again, Biden voters who are voting, again, for Republican candidates down ballot, or Trump voters who are voting for Democrat candidates down ballot, which doesn't really follow any line of argument, but it's just the counter. And ultimately, there's not a lot of evidence of that either. And so this really is getting to the point where it does come down to the margins amongst, you know, sort of some various subgroups. And really, you know, can you do a little bit better with African Americans than you normally do? Or can you do a little bit less bad with independents? Or can you do a little bit better with college educated women? Or, you know, and just again, name the group. And that's kind of where we're at this election.
Or can you peel off, or can you, you know, through negative campaigning, can you reduce the vote of some of these groups, you mm-hmm. know, for a particular candidate based on, you know, some large expenditure of money on something that, you know, comes up and helps you at the last minute.
Well, it's funny,
which is what we're seeing in the Cornyn Cornyn Hagar race right now. We'll see if it works.
Well, it's funny because this is basically just called campaigning, but in Texas, right. This is not how it's been. I mean, just to be clear.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, you and I have had, you know, conversations with Republican consultants who have commented on the fact that there's some, if not many of them, that have not had to run competitive races, you know, competitive general election races before. They know how to run a competitive primary race, but a general election race is a whole other story. And I think that's what we're seeing right now, again, particularly in these competitive suburban and exurban races. Mm-hmm. So with that, we were going to talk about dynamics of the election system, but that'll wait till next week. So thank you for listening. Be sure to check the Texas Tribune for the last day of poll rollout, and we will have data sets, literally thousands of graphics based on this poll on the Texas Politics Project website, probably by the time you hear this. That's texaspolitics.utexas.edu. So for Josh Blank and also our excellent technical crew who helped us solve problems today in the Liberal Arts Development Studio at the University of Texas at Austin, thanks. And from everybody, thanks to you for listening and have a good week. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.